Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Joining us this week is Dan Egan. He is the executive director of Feeding New York State. You can find out more at feedingnys.org. Welcome to the Capital Connection, Dan Egan.
Thank you, David. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. As I said before we walked into the studio, I'm sorry I haven't connected with you earlier to have you on this program. Obviously, food insecurity has been on the rise. It has now a new wrinkle with federal legislation and what will happen. But before we get into it, what brought you, Dan Egan, to this organization? I read that when you started Feeding New York State, there was 1.5 people, including you. And
that's right.
Now you have 10 staff, you have lots of money coming in grants, and you're doing some good work. So how did you get involved with this, Dan Egan?
Oh, boy, I kind of don't know where to start. I guess I picked my parents well. And they raised us to be of service. And that's just, you know, been something that I've always felt I had to do and will continue to do. You know, I think a life well lived is a life serving other people.
Have you considered that that may not be continuing that tradition among families as much as it was in our day?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think that continues. I'll give you two great examples. We got two employees at Feeding New York State who were born in the 21st century. And they're amazed when I tell them I knew people born in the 1800s. That just feels really weird to say. But my grandparents were all born in the 1800s, right? So, you know, they're young, they're enthusiastic, they got great hearts, they're smart, they work hard. I absolutely have great faith in the next generation. They're actually a better generation than ours.
Well, certainly with the value system that they have on some of the major issues that we're having division over right now, I would agree. But the idea that people go hungry anywhere in this country is an anathema, isn't it?
It's unconscionable. I think it's a great shame in our country. I like to say, and because it's true, we are here in the United States in the 21st century, and for the last 150 or so years, we have been the biggest, richest, most dynamic, most innovative, freest economy on the planet, the richest place in human history. And yet, we have 3 million New Yorkers. We have about 15% of the population of the United States living with hunger, you know, working or, you know, retired after 50 plus years of contributing to their community, who can't put food on the table. And that's not right. At the same time, and we should probably talk about this a little bit, we're wasting about 40% of all the food we create in the United States. You know, between the farm and, you know, your home, 40% of that food never gets consumed by anybody. It's going in the trash. It's going in landfills. It's getting plowed under. So here we are. We have this incredible economy. By any measure, again, the best in human history. We're throwing out mountains of food, and we have 3 million New Yorkers who are hungry. That's shameful. It's not right. We have it within our power to change that, to make sure everybody's got enough, and yet we don't do it.
Well, Dan Egan, executive director of Feeding New York State, I heard your interview with David Lombardo of the Capital Press Room, my colleague, and he asked, you know, why? Is it the economy? Is it, you know, is it wages? Is it SNAP benefits? Should we do more there? But I go back to the definition, the definitional question. How do we define hunger and what it means? In other words, shouldn't we be covering the basic human rights that people should have, like hunger, like health care, certain things that all of us in this free society, with what you just said about the richest country on planet Earth, should be able to provide for everyday Americans, no matter what?
Well, yes.
A little more complicated than that,
Well, yes and no. It's complicated. You know, economics is complicated. We've got, you know, there's a lot going on, right? Nothing's simple. All the things you just said, you know, is it wages? Is it housing? Is it cost of living? Is it SNAP? The answer is yes. It's all of those things. But it's so interesting the way you just framed that question in terms of rights, right? Because where do we get our rights? And typically we look to things like the United States Constitution, where, for example, you know, you and I have the right to sit here and talk about this right now. And
correct.
We can criticize anybody we want.
For now.
For now. You know, I'm looking over my shoulder right now, and it's, you know, we have to joke about these things or we couldn't cope. But, you know, it's not funny that free speech is being squelched in this country. So there's our set of political rights in the Constitution. You know, the right to have enough to eat, the right to shelter is not in there. Those are economic rights. Now, I would argue that you can't separate the political and the economic. In fact, in a lot of academic circles, they use the term political economy, which I think is a good term because they're, in fact, they are one thing. You know, it's sort of an artificial distinction to separate them. But I would also look back, you know, I'm a history nerd. I always, I think we can get a lot of guidance from our history. And one of our great governors was Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm.
He created a document called the Atlantic Charter and, you know, talked about the four freedoms. And one of those, you know, it's in the FDR Museum in Hyde Park, is freedom from want, which is kind of an old-fashioned expression, right? But that's what it means, what you just said, to have the political right to have enough, to have shelter, to have food. And, you know, that was 80 years ago that he had that vision. Why haven't we implemented that? And I don't know. There's about 20 million people in New York, and 3 million of them are hungry, 1 out of 5 children.
And that's gone up, right? That has gone
up a bit, yes. It's gotten worse since I started working on it, so that's not good.
Despite your best efforts, and you are trying.
We try, and we're doing a lot, but you have to get at the root cause stuff, and you're asking exactly the right questions. It's about the cost of living. It's about how we structure our economy. You know, there's things that states can do. There's things that not-for-profits can do. There's things that communities can do.
And isn't that what we leave to those organizations to do in our society? Because my argument would be, and forgive me for interrupting you, Dan, but this is where I'm going to go right to the point.
Okay.
Our society, this democratic, supposed democratic free society, is mm-hmm. really a capitalist society that values money over human beings. That's why we can't seem to get into our conscience and say, hey, wait a minute. The people that we need to take care of at the bottom ultimately amounts to crumbs when it comes to money with the amount of wealth that's up at the top. This is the defining issue of this country, and you can draw a straight line to hunger.
Boy, you set me up with a tough one there.
Can't help it.
I would respond to that in two ways. I'm going to say both yes and no. Yes, I think that that's been historically probably pretty accurate. But no, it doesn't need to be that way.
Yeah.
Let us not give in to cynicism. And I'm not calling you cynical at all. But I think that there's a tendency in our culture to become cynical about politics, to make these kinds of statements. Well, it's just money, you know. Elected officials only care about getting reelected, you know, on and on and on. You know the argument. There's some truth in that, but it doesn't have to be that way. And I've seen it change. I've seen the difference. You know, the first part of your question made me think of a guy I saw a couple weeks ago. I went out to get coffee because I'm a boy, I like coffee.
Me too.
And fellas on the street corner, obviously homeless, asked me for a couple of bucks. We were across the street from the New York State Capitol, and I had to just think about this for a second. Now, here's this guy, just like me. He's asking for a couple dollars. What do I do for a living? I walk in that Capitol building, and I ask for a couple dollars for people who are hungry. What's the difference between him and me? I think the answer is nothing except what you just said, money. We look down on the guy who's asking for $2 on the corner, and then, you know, we look at the lobbyist in the suit asking for millions of dollars, and we think they're different. They're not. And money cannot define our humanity.
And that lobbyist, by one healthcare problem or one cataclysmic personal event, mm-hmm. can be that guy on the corner asking for money.
Absolutely. We saw that in COVID vividly. I mean, it happens every day, but it happened in mass when COVID started. I'll never forget, you know, seeing the lines of cars, the lines of people, and they were people who had recently had very good jobs, some of them. And boy, there they were, you know, one paycheck away from needing charitable food.
And that's, quite frankly, one of the interesting things about the demographic of who people are that are hungry. It doesn't track with just your sort of stereotypical people who are poor, but there are people who sacrifice and are food insecure all around us in our communities, and we may not even realize it, maybe because they feel they'll be looked down upon if they show up at a food pantry. A lot of times it's the mother or the father or both foregoing food for their children. So this demographic is not a stereotypical one when you look at hunger.
Well, then that's another tough issue you're throwing over here.
Sorry.
Yeah, we do have these stereotypes in our society, and it's part of our problem is the stereotypes. We value individualism in America, which is a wonderful thing. I mean, in most respects, that's wonderful. In some respects, it's brutal because we look at people who are fit a category, who are in a set of circumstances, and we say it's your fault. It's generally not their fault. I mean, for you to believe that, then you would have to believe, for example, that in the 1930s, millions of Americans suddenly became lazy or something like that, right? Clearly, that's not the driver of poverty. We know from our research and just from talking to people who come to food pantries, these are our neighbors. These are our community members. They're our brothers and sisters. We know from talking to them that most of those households are employed. We know a lot of them are elderly. We know they're more likely to be veterans. We know they're more likely to be children. So it's about 15% of all New Yorkers who are hungry, but about 20% of children. About 10% of white New Yorkers, but about 25% of Black and Latino New Yorkers, right? So we need to talk about those things. These are clearly structural things. You know, I don't know what everybody's stereotype is, but the fact is, you know, take the long view here. This country's had about 250 years of history, and there's never been one day in those 250 years when everybody had everything they needed. We choose to create this economy, and we recreate this economy every day, where some people have more than they can use, and some people don't have basic necessities. When I first started this job, I was visiting some colleagues in Long Island, and I was kind of joking, and I said, boy, I bet there's no food pantry in the Hamptons. And the person I was with said, oh, yes, there is. You know, and I was a little embarrassed because, well, you know, why would you think that? Well, alongside the great wealth that we have in this state and this country, we have great poverty. And sometimes it's right down the street. And it's this one system we have, this economy that is doing both things, creating great wealth, creating great poverty. It's always been that way to a greater or lesser extent. It's gotten worse in the last 55 years or so, beginning in the 1970s, when middle-class incomes really froze and haven't changed since then.
Yeah, because cost of living increases did not follow.
Right, and you had tremendous productivity gains, for example, in the 90s, beginning in the 90s, when the IT revolution really took off. So our economy, you know, to go back to the beginning, is more productive, more innovative than it's ever been. It's throwing out enormous wealth, but that wealth is accumulating in a very small number of hands.
Yeah.
And I think if you talk to top economists of any political stripe, right, this is not a partisan statement I'm about to make. Economies function best when the wealth is widely shared. It doesn't mean you can't have some inequality, but when you have too much, it jams up the works, and that's what we're experiencing right now.
And you just took us right back to Franklin Roosevelt.
Franklin Roosevelt, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, a lot of these key figures in our history that changed things, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, right?
Yeah. We're speaking with Dan Egan. He is the executive director of Feeding New York State. You can go to feedingnys.org. There's all sorts of resources there, folks. Links to food pantries, ways to get help, how to participate and get involved, the programs they offer, what they're trying to do on the state level, and looking at the federal impact. And I think we should go there. Before we do, I just want to make one comment, and that is demos, democracy. Demos means we.
Mm-hmm.
Capitalism is I, individualism. And so our society seems to be a constant tussle between those two values. We as Americans, I as the entrepreneur, or I in my own, pick myself up by my bootstraps.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, nobody does anything alone.
That's right. I didn't know where you're going with that, but that's exactly how I was going to respond. Nobody does anything alone. You know, President Obama said, you know, you didn't build that, right? Remember that expression? And
yeah,
people got a bit upset at that. But I'd go back to Bill Gates Sr., the father of the Microsoft guy, right? So Bill Gates Jr. founded Microsoft, became a billionaire. We all know that stuff, right? Bill Gates Sr. has done speaking tours where he advocates for higher taxation for the wealthiest Americans. Why does he do that? He uses his son's career as the example. He says, you know, okay, Bill Gates, the Microsoft guy, you know, smart guy, smart businessman, saw an opportunity, took it, made a lot of money. Good for him. He could not have done that in other places and other times. You know, suppose Bill Gates were born in Mogadishu instead of Seattle, where there is no functioning government, where there is no functioning marketplace, where there are not highly educated workers all around, where there isn't, you know, an infrastructure that, you know, frankly has a lot of public content. You know, the internet, which is the biggest engine of economic growth we've seen in a generation, you know, that started as a U.S. federal government project. So his point is just what you said, that it's our culture, it's our society, it's the whole economy that comes together to create this wealth, to create success, to create innovation. So I guess I would push back at this idea that capitalism is about I don't think Adam Smith would have made that argument. I don't think David Ricardo would have made that argument. You know, the founding thinkers. It's about how you
organize
society.
But I think many Americans would interpret that that way. In other words, hey, I got mine, you get yours.
You're absolutely right about that, but that's a myth. And I'm trying to remember, there's a writer who said, I'm forgetting his name, he said, ideology is a fiction that does not know it's fiction. This is a fiction that we tell ourselves that, you know, I did it myself. This is completely about me. No, it's never about you. It's always about collective effort. And sure, that some people have better ideas than others. You know, of course, we're all different. And honestly, that's one of the most wonderful things about this country is that you got so much diversity. I mean, we're sitting here in Albany, just a little city, right? And we've got 40 languages in our public
schools. Really amazing.
It's awesome.
And it's really great. Exactly. It's awesome. Well, Dan Egan, I could talk to you all day, but we need to get to a little bit more concrete, which is, well, let's kind of sum it up this way. Look, you have gone to New York State. You've asked for things like food being a basic right, healthy food, guaranteeing healthy school meals for children, guarantee
which
that
we got.
Yeah, which you got. Yeah. Guarantee that all New Yorkers who participate in SNAP receive at least $100 per month. Mm-hmm. It goes on. Now, you thank the governor for what they did in this budget. I think that's appropriate. I think New York, as a blue state, tends to do a lot more than many other states in terms of their services, but you said it's not enough.
Correct.
Now we got the big, beautiful bill and that impact. So let's go back to collective efforts. It's going to take quite a collective effort, and you guys are partnering with so many folks.
Yes.
I imagine this conversation is ongoing, but how are you preparing right now for what may be coming?
Well, it's going to be very tough. So we know, and you know, this has been in the news, right? No secret. There's a brand new $3 billion hole in the New York State budget for next year. That's got to come from somewhere. And I don't envy the people who have to figure that out. And contrary to what a lot of people might think, you know, and I thought at one time in the distant past, you know, you look at the Capitol and you say, oh, man, you know, I don't know if I can trust the people who work in that building. There's a lot of great people working
there
in
are.
That building, a lot of great elected officials who supported a lot of these things you just named. It's going to be tough. It's going to take a lot of advocacy. I think, you know, essentially a defensive effort to make sure that we don't lose the gains that we've gotten over the last few years. Universal school meals was a tremendous victory, and people worked on that for a decade. We were a small part of that, but we were proud to be a part of that. We created Nourish New York, which is a $55 million program that helps us feed people using food we buy from New York farmers. So there's a lot of good that's happened, but a lot is under threat. So I think it's really important. This could be a year where advocates really need to regroup, really think hard.
And this really brings us right to that issue you brought up in the beginning, which is how much food waste there is in our society. I'm already giving myself a little punch in the shoulder to watch my meals and not leave anything on that plate. But it's so important. Your mom used to say when you were little, they're going to go hungry in other countries if you don't finish, but they're going to go hungry in the same county or on the next street or on your block.
Yes.
And the truth is we need better ways to deal with food waste.
We do. We've got some good stuff going on in New York, and I would also call your attention to California. The California Association of Food Banks is doing some great work there. But we've got a food rescue program we started about 3 years ago. We're getting a lot of food from grocery stores, bodegas, corner stores. Right?
How does that work?
it's enough to restore your faith in humanity, because the way it works is you walk up, you call them or you knock on the door and you say, hi, I'm from Feeding New York, or I'm from food bank such and such, and will you donate your excess food? And I would say 90%+ of the time, people enthusiastically say, yes, tell me how I can help.
That's great.
Show me how to start this donation program. I want to help. Same thing with farmers. People who are in the food industry, farmers, grocery store owners, corner store owners, they're in the food business. They like the food business, especially farmers. It's a way of life. It's not just a job. They want to help people. They understand that there's people who don't have enough and they want to help. They're waiting to be asked. So we ask.
No one wants to see people hungry.
Right. It's a real clash, right? So if we go back to like those myths we tell ourselves, right?
Yeah.
But the fact is that most people are really kind and good-hearted and they want to help. Right. And so we ask them and they say, sure. And then the hard part is showing up with a truck every day or every week. You know, that costs money to do. There's thousands of volunteers across the state. But fundamentally, you need to pay somebody to drive a truck. You need to get the truck. You need to put fuel in it. You know, all those things. You need to have good, clean bins and you need to train people. So there's a lot of work that goes into that. But we're doing that for about 14 cents a pound. We've rescued about 52 million pounds of food over the last 3.5 years. California's doing even better. And this is starting to take off as a concept in other states. It's not working well everywhere. So there's a bunch of academics looking at that, which is great. That's useful. But so much more could be done. That's something that New York State could do very easily. You know, the New York State budget is, I forget how many billions of dollars now, but the investment in food rescue is about $2 million a year. So if you doubled that, you know, another $2 million in the New York State budget, that's a rounding error, to beef up those efforts, to put more trucks and drivers on the road, you'd get another 50 million pounds because the amount of waste out there is just incredible. And people are willing to do the right thing and make sure that this perfectly good food you'd be proud to serve anybody in your family gets where it needs to go.
Including what you said in the beginning about the younger generation.
Mm-hmm.
Their values seem to be much stronger in terms of their willingness to support human beings with collective action on a variety of fronts.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be a good sign that in the future we may drop some of this current attitude toward each other and maybe come together.
Yeah, I think it's in our nature to come together. I've been lucky. It may sound bizarre to say this, but I've been lucky. I do feel lucky that I've been to so many food distributions and handed boxes of food to people and worked alongside volunteers. People love to help each other out. People want to participate in the political process. I'll tell you one quick story. I was in Queens this winter, and we were doing a food distribution. It was one of those brutally cold days we had this past winter. It was like 10 degrees. And we're down by the river in Astoria, so it was extra cold. And I got there maybe 8 in the morning. There were 200 people lined up waiting for food.
Oh.
During that morning, we served about 300 people, okay? But one of the things we did is after people got their food, we asked them, these were folks working with City Harvest, one of our members, and asked people, do you want to sign a petition or call your state representative to help us do this work? And about 200 of the 300 people there that day said, oh, yeah, yes. And I was listening to them. I was watching them as I'm hauling sacks of potatoes, and my back was sore. I'm not young anymore. But I saw the enthusiasm. I saw people were so eager to participate. Now, some people were afraid because of the, you know, what we're seeing in our at the federal level. Some people were afraid. But 200 of the 300, roughly, were like, oh, yes. And I remember this one woman said, oh, yes, I'll sign. Like, she couldn't wait to engage. I heard 5 or 6 languages that morning and very positive response. People are eager to play their part. I think this is a cultural thing you're pointing out that, you know, we have this sort of manufactured conflict that I don't think it runs that deep. I mean, it's scary, but I don't think it really runs deep in people. I think when people talk to each other, when they encounter each other face to face, a lot of that goes away and people can understand each other.
Yeah, we got to get back face to face. I mean, the social media is...
It's a killer.
It's a killer.
Literally a killer.
Yeah, and I have students that have a hard time wanting to do interviews in person.
So right, but when you're face-to-face with a person, you know, it's much harder to get angry with people. It's much easier to understand each other. You know, I think back, like, you know, when you put people in service in the military, you know, you have people coming from all walks of life. Suddenly they got to sleep in the same barracks and work together, you know, 20 hours a day. Pretty soon all the barriers are broken down and nobody cares where you're from, whether you have money, what your accent is. Does not matter. We need to have some deliberate effort at that again in our society to put people together, because social media is tearing people apart. And if you look under the hood, you know, this is all pretty well documented. The algorithms are being designed for controversy, for negativity, for conflict. We need to have the, you know, the in the flesh algorithm of let's shake hands, let's talk, let's figure this out together.
And think about it like every presidential speech opens with, my fellow Americans.
That's right. That's right. You know, the term we use in food banking is neighbors. These are our neighbors. You know, they're not clients. They're not.
Right.
You know, they're our neighbors. That's the right word to use. We're not better than anybody else. We're neighbors. We're here in this community together. Let's make sure we're taking care of everybody.
Dan Egan, Executive Director of Feeding New York State. You are a breath of fresh air. What a pleasure it has been talking with you. I thank you for your efforts in trying to feed the hungry in our great state. And I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Capital Connection this week.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. It's been nice talking to you.
You too.
Face to face.
Face to face. Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.